I have to say, I don't like coming to for the hot topics because they're always the more sensitive topics. It's not as easy to have fun and to joke because you have to be more precise. So if I bore you to tears through precision, I apologize. And if I'm not precise, I apologize even more. The way I'd like to approach this issue is to talk about meaning. We all desire meaning. We want meaning in life. We want our lives to have meaning. And this is a motivation for much of what we do. In order for us to have meaning, in order for anything to have meaning, it must have limits. To define something, in other words, to articulate its meaning, is to set its limits. So, those of you who have studied Latin, which I hope is all of you, you'll call to mind that the word define comes from the Latin define. It's regarding the limits of the thing. To define something, to give it meaning, is to define its limits. In order for anything to have meaning, it must have certain limits. And if it doesn't have certain limits, it's not that it gains more meaning. It means that it spills out of control and has no meaning whatsoever. So this is as regards speech, for example. We want words to have meaning. We want what people say to us to mean something. When a young man looks at his girlfriend and pops the question or says to her, "I love you," she wants those words to have meaning. She wants them to mean something. We've got a whole school of philosophy now that says that, you know, words don't really have meaning. And those who subscribe to this use words to argue that point. We want our speech to have meaning. We want our actions to have meaning. A handshake, something as simple as that. We want that to have meaning. And somebody who gives a bad handshake or gives us a handshake and then betrays us, we are offended by that because we realize that simple human gesture, that action, should carry with it a certain meaning. Our speech, our actions, we want these things to have meaning, and the human body. One of the greatest developments in theology in the past 40 or so years is, of course, John Paul II's theology of the body. And in that, what he is articulating is the meaning of the human body. Against everything that the modern world says, the human body is just, you know, this arbitrary thing that we can tinker with and do with as we want. John Paul II has articulated this profound theology that says, no, actually, the human body is indicative of a deeper spiritual and theological truth. Our bodies have meanings. And for that reason, they have certain limits. Which brings us to the issue of sexuality. We want human sexuality to have meaning. If it doesn't have meaning, then every act of love between a married couple, well, is meaningless. It doesn't say anything. It's just a physical act, and that's the end of it. We want these things to have meaning because they bring, well, meaning to our lives. They fulfill our lives. They fill out our lives so that life is suddenly worth living because we realize that everything that we are about is charged with meaning. Or another way of understanding it is that we want these things to have some purpose so that what we do in life is not arbitrary. It's not without purpose. So what's this best-selling book, I guess, The Purpose-Driven Life? Okay, great idea. Well, the Catholic Church is called that virtues. but it's a bestseller because people respond to it immediately. We want our lives to have purpose or meaning. And in order for that to happen, we have to define the limits of things. We have to articulate what certain things are for. In philosophy, they'll call this final causality. We ask, well, what is this for? What's the purpose of it? And if we can't articulate a purpose for it or the meaning of it, then we usually abuse it or get rid of it. So at one point we looked at 8-track tapes. I remember them. And we said, well, what was the purpose of this? And nobody could articulate an answer to that. So we got rid of them, and now CDs are going the same way. For something to have meaning, it must have a purpose. For human sexuality to have meaning, it must have a purpose. What is the purpose of this? The purpose, as Janet Smith likes to summarize it, is for babies and bonding. The baby's part is pretty simple to figure out. Don't need to be a rocket scientist. Rocket science would help. The baby's part is pretty evident. The bonding part, it indicates that we are more than just bodies, that we are embodied souls. And so this act of the body, this sexual act between a married man and woman, this carries with it not just a physical and biological purpose, but also a spiritual purpose. It unites these two persons. One writer on this topic has observed that the human sexual organs, and Harry and Barr talking about these things. I guess we probably talked about a lot in bars, but not in this manner. That of all the organs of the human body, the sexual organs are the only organs that are incomplete in themselves, that they only make sense in union with another person, biologically, and also, as John Paul II has said, not just biologically, not just physically, it's not just a physical reality of this union, but that physical reality indicates a deeper meaning of union and love between two persons. Every other aspect of our body, every other organ functions for itself and for the body is sort of self-contained. But our sexuality points us to the other, points us to the creation of life and union with another person. Now, having said all of that, I'd like to lay that groundwork because when we turn to address the issue of homosexuality, we must always do so within the broader context of the Church's teaching on human sexuality. Because it looks absurd to single out homosexuality as sort of the only issue of sexuality in the culture today. Obviously, it is a serious one, but there are many others that have preceded it and enable this issue to be as powerful as it is. The Church does not have two different standards for chastity, one for those who are heterosexual and one for those who are homosexual. It is one standard of chastity because there is one human sexuality that we are all obliged to live. We're all obliged to live according to the truth of it, according to its limits, according to its meaning. And so, homosexuality is the issue that we must address within the context of Church's teaching, entire teaching on human sexuality. Somebody asked me earlier, before the talk, about the political dimension of this. I'm not going to get too much into that because, quite honestly, it's not the most important part. But really, if you know a politician who's been divorced and remarried three times, when he gets up and rails against homosexual marriage, well, he might have a point in principle. He certainly has a point in principle, but he looks ridiculous making it because he has already emptied marriage of its meaning. And so, although he may have stumbled upon the truth, he's not the best person to articulate it because he has already betrayed the truth himself. So what does the Church teach in this regard, as regards homosexuality? This calls for a number of distinctions. Let me point out two opposing sides in this argument, and the Church is with neither group. On one extreme, and I apologize in advance if some of my language offends, but there are a lot of lot of people who speak on this topic who use offensive words, and I'm not taking them as my own, but using them as examples. On one extreme, you have those, it's the God hates fags crowd. And years ago, I had that phrase in my mind from somewhere, and I couldn't remember where, and I Googled it. And sure enough, it came up. There's a group with that title. And I was amazed by this. And their basic thinking is this. If someone has same-sex attractions, if someone has a sexual attraction to a person of the same sex, that person is automatically homosexual, and God hates that person. That's one extreme. The other extreme is the radical homosexual lobby, which proceeds by the same logic, that if a person has a sexual attraction to another person of the same sex, that person is homosexual, and therefore should live a homosexual life, and should buy into the entire culture the homosexual lobby sort of proposes. And the church is on neither end of the spectrum. Notice that both of these groups they make the same error. They collapse the person into his or her sexual attractions. They believe that sexual attractions define the person. The church's view of the human person is much deeper and much broader than that. That sexual attractions are an aspect of the human person, an aspect of human sexuality, but they do not define the person. And so much of the work that I do with Courage is precisely just to articulate this point again and again and again. That just because a man or a woman feels these attractions to a person of the same sex, that doesn't define that man or that woman. That their identity is much broader and much deeper than that. I had a conversation one time with a man who came in to speak to me about this issue, and he said, "Father, I'm gay." And I said, "No, you're not." And he looked a little confused. And he said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "No, you're not." I had his attention at that point. And I'm pleased to say that he saw my point very quickly. To say I am gay, for someone to say that, is to collapse sexual identity into the person and the person is a sexual identity, to make them the same thing. In order to free a person from that, it's necessary to make the distinction between the attractions and the person. That is the most crucial distinction to make. If I had the catechism here, I would read it, but that would be really boring. But let me point out how the catechism proceeds. The catechism distinguishes three different things here. First is homosexual acts, which the church teaches are intrinsically disordered. What that means is that the actions are. The church does not teach that persons are intrinsically disordered. Has never taught that. But the actions are. There are many moral actions that are intrinsically disordered. Homosexual acts happen to be one of them. And what that means is that no situation can make them right. Abortion, for example, is intrinsically disordered. Most of the time, women are forced into this choice. It doesn't make the choice right. It doesn't make it morally good. And so also homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered. No amount of affection, no amount of goodwill can make them morally good. Second, the catechism talks about homosexual attractions. Homosexual attractions, catechism describes as objectively disordered. They are not immoral in themselves. This is a very important distinction. Feelings in and of themselves cannot be morally good or morally bad. They're simply feelings. They become morally charged when we act on them. But there are certain feelings that are leading us to the wrong thing and certain feelings that are leading us to the right things. And this is not unique for people of same-sex attraction. This is just the human condition. St. Paul talks about this. Why do I do the very thing that I don't want to do? And I don't do the very thing that I do want to do. He's talking about his feelings or his passions leading him astray. Homosexual attractions are objectively disordered, meaning just not making any commentary about the particular person. It is in the objective realm not proper for a man to be attracted to a man. Why not? Well, because that is not the purpose of human sexuality. It doesn't fulfill either of the purposes. Babies cannot come about, nor can there be a real bonding because, well, as we learn from the theology of the body, the bodies of two men together cannot communicate that complementarity that is necessary for union. And so the attractions are objectively disordered, but still the person has not been mentioned. The actions are intrinsically disordered. The attractions are objectively disordered. What about the person? And here, the church says, well, the person is good. A human person is always a good. It doesn't matter what the attractions of that person feels. That person can still be good, and it is called to holiness. This is one of the boldest paragraphs in the Catechism. It calls those with same-sex attractions to holiness. Not just to physical continence. It's not just saying, okay, well, you just got to control yourself and that's it. No, you have a particular weakness, an attraction that is not right, but you're called to holiness. And as is true for everyone, it is the struggle against our sinful inclinations that makes us holy. We don't become holy despite the struggle. Gosh, if I just got over my human weakness, then I could be holy. No. It is by struggling with our human weakness and availing ourselves of every opportunity from God's grace that we become holy. And that's the church's message to those with same-sex attractions. That the actions are wrong, the attractions are disordered, but the person is good. And so what we must always do is distinguish the person from the actions. Distinguish the person from the attractions. Distinguishing the person from the actions is what we do every time we go to confession. Think about it. When you go to confession, what do you do? Well, here I am, this is me in person, and here are the things that I have done. And I want these two things to be distinguished. In fact, I want them to be separated and completely infinite distance between them. In confession, what do? We hate the sin and love the sinner. And this is the proper Catholic attitude towards everyone, and in this context, to those with same-sex attractions. To love the person and to call that person to the holiness which God has created them. But also to witness to the truth of human sexuality, therefore the limits of human sexuality. That just because we're sexual creatures doesn't mean that we can do whatever we want with our sexuality. In order for it to have meaning, it must have limits. And those who say, well, it can mean whatever we want it to mean, are in effect saying it means nothing. Chesterton observed, you knew that I was going to quote Chesterton, those of you that have talked before. When people stop believing in God, it's not that they will not believe in anything. It's that they will believe in absolutely anything. So also with human sexuality. Once the limits are removed, it's not that it suddenly means a new thing. No, it means nothing. And unfortunately, in popular culture, that's what we're witnessing. And the beginning of it is not homosexuality. Quite honestly, it's heterosexual unchastity. And so when we discuss this emotionally, politically charged issue of sexuality, we have to step back and realize that it's all of a piece. And if we want to witness to the truth of human sexuality, then every single one of us has to live in. And it's not just something we can say, well, those who have homosexual attractions, they must live chastity. No, everybody has to live chastity. It reminds me of what some of my friends in college said when I told them that I was entering the seminary, I was going to be a priest. One of them said, dude. You know, that means you can't have sex. And I felt like saying, you're kidding. They didn't tell me that part. But instead I said to him, well, neither can you until you're married. And he went, oh. We can't single out one group. Chastity is something that everyone is called to live. What has paved the way for this, quite honestly, is the pill. I mean, in our cultural history, I mean, there's always been unchastity. The pill, by removing one of the intrinsic aspects of human sexuality, by removing the limits of human sexuality, also removed its meaning. And once its meaning was removed, other sexually unchaste actions suddenly became tolerable. And so it's no surprise that, you know, a rise in fornication and adultery and pornography have followed in its wake. And so we want to witness to this, every single one of us, not just those of us who have same-sex attractions, but every single one of us must strive to live chastity. Another thing I want to point out about the Catechism. As some of you might know, the Catechism was originally written in French. And then the official version was written in Latin. It was translated from the French into the Latin. And when it went from the French into the Latin, certain changes were made in the official version. Unfortunately, it had already been translated from French into many other languages, and so the Vatican has to kind of go back and say, all right, we need to update the catechism that we released 4 years ago. And in the updating of that catechism, there's some very significant changes, and one of them has to do with this issue. The Vatican backed away from language describing homosexuality as a fixed orientation, and instead described it as an inclination. This is one of not just a great change theologically and philosophically and morally, but also just in terms of charity, to make that distinction. Because if you say it's an orientation, then you have just locked that person into that orientation. You say, well, that's fixed now. There's no getting away from it. And remember the two extremes. They both thrive on this mistake. And so the Vatican backed away from that language, and instead of describing homosexuality as an orientation, described it as an inclination, which is very different. It is not something, in other words, that is part and parcel of the individual, but something that the individual experiences. Some misconceptions about the Church's teaching in this regard. Some will say that the Church teaches that homosexuals are intrinsically disordered. No, and you won't find a document that says that. The Church teaches that the actions are intrinsically disordered, not the persons. And again, they'll say, well, the Church teaches that I am objectively disordered. No, that's not what the Church teaches. The Church teaches that the attractions are objectively disordered. But again, always distinguishing the person from the actions and from the attractions. How else do we witness to this truth? A precision of terms. I've been using the clumsy term same-sex attractions, or people with same-sex attractions. It's clumsy. To say homosexuals would be much easier. To say gays would be much easier. One syllable. Okay. But deliberately back away from those terms because, first of all, they're politically charged. Second, they collapse the person into the sexual inclination. the man who has done more work on this than anyone else in the church is Father John Harvey. Some years ago, he wrote a book called A Homosexual Person. And he himself will tell you that was a terrible title, because there's no such thing as a homosexual person. There are divine persons, only three of them. There are angelic persons, a lot of them, and there are human persons. There's no such thing as a homosexual person. There are persons who have homosexual inclinations. And the church, in her documents, has, again, sort of changed that language to communicate this distinction. And so it's not helpful to use those terms that that fail to make the distinction. Saying that someone has same-sex attractions, yeah, it's clumsy. It doesn't kind of trip up the lips very easily, but it does have the virtue of being more precise. And the other terms, as I said, can be politically charged. Another thing that is extraordinarily important is charity in our conversation. In my work with Courage, and those of you who have perhaps never heard of it before, Courage is an apostolate founded by Father John Harvey 30 years ago, I think, or about that. And it's a very modest purpose, but it's also very controversial. And the purpose is simply, we want to help those who have same-sex attractions live chastity and increase in holiness. That's it. We're not trying to influence legislation. We just have this simple purpose right here. And do that by meetings, by ministering the sacraments, by teaching the truth. And so when I meet with our Courage chapter here in the diocese, I have to tell you, it's always a great experience. These are men. It's not exclusive to men by definition, but in our diocese it just happens that it's only men who come to the meetings. These are men who are truly courageous, and men who are fighting the fight for holiness more than most Catholics, I have to tell you. And they appreciate the Church's teachings more. They appreciate the sacraments more, and they appreciate chastity more. And they're striving for it and fighting for it more than most Catholics I know. And so it's a great experience to meet with them and to assist them as best I can in that struggle for holiness. In my work with these good men, one of the things I've learned is the damage that words can have. We all know the line, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can never hurt me. Nonsense. Nonsense. I'd much rather be hit in the face, for example, than be called a hypocrite. Okay? My face work, I'm not giving anybody permission. Okay? But you know, my face can recover, but the insult of being called a hypocrite, that stings much deeper. The pejorative terms that are used against homosexuals do tremendous damage and need to be completely rejected, because it shows a disrespect for the person. And it doesn't matter how steeped in sin a person might be. We don't show disrespect for persons. And it doesn't matter how opposed the person might be in the broader cultural and political scene. We don't show disrespect or irreverence for persons. And so we have to watch our language. And, you know, in high school, in college, the insulting words are bandied about. Please God, when people become a certain age, they have to leave them behind and show more maturity and charity. Some years ago, I was out on a hike with a youth group. One of the young men in the youth group used one of these pejorative terms, and he's still probably wondering what got into Father Scalia, because I came down on him like a ton of bricks, and it was sort of a wake-up call to him that you can't just throw words like that around. We need to respect the persons, even as opposed as we might be to what they articulate or the way they live. I think I will end there. There are many other things could discuss. I think I will leave that for the Q&A, because that usually prompts me on all the things that I've forgotten. And so I repeat the instructions for the question and answer. First, it has to be a question, okay? No statements. I'm the only one, okay? Mr. Troy, we're the only ones to do statements. And don't make it a statement. Like, you know, some people have learned the art of making a statement and then at the end saying, so what do you think of that? Okay. And one question per person, no follow-up questions. Okay, this isn't the White House. Okay, so, yes, sir.
What can we do to help people that we might encounter in the course of our lives that are struggling with something?
Okay. This is sort of the fundamental question that really is in the culture today regarding this issue. What can we do to help those who are who have same-sex attractions? And, well, in a certain sense, it depends on the person's situation. If it is a person who is struggling against them and wants to be free of them, then the assistance you can give is going to be, in many respects, the same, but it's going to be applied differently. With a person in that situation, encouraging them to confession and just cultivating that friendship and always distinguishing the person from the attractions and never pigeonholing the person and saying, oh, this is who you are. But trying to be natural in that regard. I will say something right now that is extraordinarily politically incorrect. I mean, not that the whole thing isn't, but... you know, therapy is an option. And this is something that many in the homosexual community really hate to hear. But there is evidence that reparative therapy of homosexual attractions is possible. That someone can seek out that therapy, and it's very intense, and it takes a lot, and it takes a lot of courage. But that therapy can help to heal the person of those attractions so that they can at least be free from the attractions to a certain degree. But in some cases, can actually cultivate heterosexual attractions. And I know a man who, statistically speaking, should be dead right now because he was in the midst of the homosexual, the worst of the worst of the homosexual culture in the late 70s, early 80s. When AIDS was breaking out and they didn't know it, he should be dead given the number of partners he had. He's married with a couple kids. Okay, and he is free from unchaste acts that plague most men. Hope I'm vague in one way and clear in another. Okay. But what about the other situation? What about someone who does not accept this? Does not accept this teaching and say, this is who I am, this is how I have to live. At that point, well, prayer is always our most important weapon, but in this regard, we're going to fall back on that more and more. In that situation, again, the same rule applies. You love the person, and you make that known. And we don't do that enough, making known our love for the person. Even as you say, I cannot agree with the life that you've chosen to live. I love you, but I cannot agree with this, and I'm not gonna co-opt it into approving it. It's a very difficult thing to do, but if you do that, years down the road, you might be the reason that a person comes back, for example, back to the church, or you might be the reason that a person leaves the lifestyle. And that's an extraordinary, extraordinary blessing. But keeping in touch with the person who's in that situation, not letting the person co-opt you into identifying them as gay or as homosexual, as lesbian, whatever. But saying, no, you're my friend, you're my sibling, you're my parent in some cases. I love you, but I can't approve what you're doing. And I'll continue to love you. And it's a very difficult line to walk, but that is what we're called to do. And again, that's what we do for ourselves whenever we enter confession, and that's what we're called to do for others. we have to be careful that we don't fall to one side or the other. And this is the classic scenario. Some people fall to one side and say, well, I love you, therefore I approve of everything that you do. That is not love. And then on the other side is, well, I disapprove of what you do, so I'm cutting off all contact with you, and I'm sending back everything that you ever gave me, and I'm removing you from the family Bible, and that's not healthy either. It takes genuine Christian charity to be faithful both to the truth about human sexuality and our love for the particular person.
What's your response to the medical argument?
Okay. What is my explanation or reaction to the medical explanation of same-sex attractions? Well, there hasn't been conclusive, slam-dunk scientific establishment that homosexuality is hereditary. I mean, every once in a while, Newsweek or Time will say, aha! They found, Ekmanazi College, there's an article, they found the gay gene. I remember that. They were like, aha, this is it. I haven't heard much about it since because it was a distortion of a study. In my reading of it, my understanding is that there are certain medical things that can predispose a person to this, but there's nothing that locks a person into it. Now, for the sake of argument, let us say that there is something that locks a person into same-sex attractions. That wouldn't make acting out on them correct. Okay, we can use the equivalent of, some people say that alcoholism is hereditary. That's not proven. Some people believe that. What if alcoholism were hereditary? Okay, it's hereditary, so I'm just going to drink as much as I want. Okay, and we wouldn't say, well, it's hereditary, so he can drink as much as he wants. No, we would say, no, he's doing damage to himself by this. And so even though he might have a predisposition, even though he might have this weakness, he still has to control himself. Likewise with same-sex attractions.
Spotter, it could be a service to us if we could better address the objections of our opponents. Inclination versus orientation. I'm a professional dance teacher also, and I see a lot of people in the dance community who, if they never had sex with anyone or never discussed sex, I could pick them out in the crowd and tell you that they were gay.
The question?
In the grand scheme of things, the question really is, your case really rests on it being an inclination, not an orientation. And I don't really think that we have hard evidence yet, do we? That it's inclination, not orientation? Because the gays are out there saying, if it's orientation and we're not producing babies, it's just love. What do we say?
Okay. This is I intentionally did not begin by addressing the arguments of our opponents, but by our opponents I mean those who articulate a view of human sexuality that is contrary to what the church has always taught. I don't want to play defense all the time. It might work for the Ravens. We want to play offense and articulate the beauty of human sexuality. The distinction between inclination and orientation is the fundamental one, and this is why I kept saying we distinguish the person from the attraction. If we say it's an orientation, we just collapse the two together and say anyone who has this attraction is this way. We're better off to speak of it as an inclination because it's something that some people experience. But this is an issue that influences all of us, some of us directly. Those of us who have same-sex attractions obviously influences us directly. But all of us probably know people who struggle with this, maybe have family members who struggle with it. But in the broader cultural scene, the reason this is so important is because it empties human sexuality of its meaning. It removes the limits of it. And once you remove the limits, it no longer has any meaning. And so when two people come together, we've lost the sense that there's a meaning to their union. Okay, so I don't want to keep responding to the opponents, but rather to articulate, you know, what the church is always taught in this regard, and the beauty of the church's teaching in this regard. I don't know why we're keeping it under a bushel basket. This year is the 40th. Last year was the 40th anniversary of Humani Vitae, one of the best documents ever promulgated by the church. Rearticulating the church's teaching against contraception and rearticulating a beautiful, beautiful understanding of human sexuality. And that's what we need to be articulating ourselves.
Can you give us some ideas for a good brief response to someone?
Okay. A good brief response. Well, go to courage.
Someone from an innocent, like political correct perspective that is accusing the church of intolerance.
Okay. Accusing the church of intolerance. Okay, there are no brief, pithy responses that are going to settle the question. Okay, Catholic moral theology is not given to sound bites. Okay, we discovered this in the last election cycle. Okay. It always, and this is why love always has to be the leading edge, because people are more likely to accept what we have to say when they know we love them. And they know it more than just kind of because we've said it. They know it because we've shown it. The Courage website is a very good, it has some good resources. There's a document called Homosexuality and Hope, put out by the Catholic Medical Association. Controversial in some quarters, but very good, I think. There's an article written in First Things a couple years ago by me. I like it. I recommend Father Harvey's books. He has I can only remember the titles of two. The Homosexual Person is first, The Truth About Homosexuality, and then he just released a third, which is kind of a question-answer book on that. And he's really done more work on this than anyone else in the church. So I would recommend that. I think showing the logical conclusion of certain principles is very important. See, the problem is that we have removed principles from our way of living and our way of thinking. And once that happens, then anything is permissible. The principle of the truth about human sexuality, that there is a truth, that there is a meaning and purpose. If somebody does not accept that, ask them, well, then what is the purpose of this union? What does it lead to? And how do we know? Okay.
Questions evolved in the past time. But how do you respond, what's your viewpoint on a gay man married and married heterosexual marriage? Is that then still a legitimate marriage? Is it really fun?
Okay. The question is about a man with same-sex attractions who's married to a woman.
Yes.
Could that be a valid marriage?
Yeah.
Absolutely, it could be. Okay. That those same-sex attractions do not automatically invalidate the marriage bond. And actually, this brings up another good thing to keep in mind, because, again, both extremes of the argument want us to think that homosexuality is sort of this monolithic reality, that if anyone has kind of the slightest attraction to another man, then just like that, he's gay, and that's the end of it. And they fail to recognize that there are degrees of attraction and that some have experienced intense attraction at a certain time in life and then a lessening of it as they grow older or as they seek therapy or whatever else. And so your question about a man who's married to a woman but he still experiences the same sex attractions, it would depend on sort of the intensity of those. Okay, it's that sometimes those with same-sex attraction can experience very intense attractions. Other times, it's sort of passing, and they can shrug it off. And this is something that culture just doesn't recognize. You watch the movies; you're either one or the other. You know, the gay character, who's always, by the way,
always more well-balanced in Hollywood standards than the heterosexual characters. But they're always one or the other. There's no recognition that this is not it's monolithic reality, that there are degrees. Okay, I'm going to go over here. Yes, sir.
Curious if you'd have any different qualifications for your statements for people who claim themselves to be transsexual. That's the latest thing.
Okay. What about those who are transsexual? Honestly, I don't really even know what that means. But the whole sort of variety of descriptions now, homosexual, transsexual, transgendered, bisexual, the whole sort of variety of definitions, that itself indicates that this is not a monolithic reality, that people are, you know, that there's a confusion here and not just, you know, a set identity. So when people start, you know, inventing new titles to describe their sexual orientation, it more and more indicates it's not an orientation as much as it is just a feeling that they've experienced, and they've tried to put a label on the feeling.
What do you say to same-sex couples who want to be married?
Okay, the marriage question. Okay, what do you say to same-sex couples that want to be married? Well, again, taking it to its logical conclusion. Once we remove the limits, we lose meaning. Marriage has meaning insofar as it has limits. I would ask them, what is the basis of marriage? What is the basis of marriage? What defines marriage? And a lot of times the response will be just love for one another. Okay, on that basis, you can marry just about anybody, okay? And there's really no limit now. As long as you love another person and are dedicated to that person, you can marry that person. We need to, in order to have any real meaning to marriage, we need to set some limits to it. And to say, you know, well, all that's necessary for marriage is you know, that you love the person and are committed to that person. That really fails to establish any limits so as to give a meaning. All right, so I would put the burden of proof on them. Why should this be regarded as marriage? What is the meaning of marriage? And this is where the past 40 years, at least, have eroded our capacity to answer this question. Because marriage used to be permanent, and it used to be life-giving. But now, with the enormous rate of divorce and contraception, you know, how many people will really say marriage is permanent and it is life-giving? And so, in a sense, I probably shouldn't say it's being taped, but in a sense, the homosexual lobby in this regard, I can understand their point. Because they're looking at the past 40 years, and they're seeing heterosexual marriage make a mockery of marriage. They're seeing, you know, men and women divorce and remarry, you know, any number of times, and contracept and sterilize themselves, fix themselves, as they say. And sure, the homosexual community watches that, and they say, well, you know, given that's the way they live marriage, what, we could do that. So, first, we need to recommit ourselves to the truth about marriage. We need to recover that. And then, I think, more to your point, what is your response? I think, well, you know, ask them to articulate the meaning of marriage. Okay? What limits would you place on marriage so as to give it meaning? And if they wouldn't place limits on it, then we might call it marriage. I'll give it a definition. I haven't heard from this table, but I will.
You spoke before when you were talking about the meaning of marriage, about a bond between a man and a woman.
Yes.
Could you kind of explain more the difference between that kind of bond and the love that homosexual couples are saying they have for each other?
Okay, wonderful question. Okay, I spoke about the bond in marriage, the marriage bond, and I used the word complementarity. And this is actually,
I don't have any original thoughts. It's just in the catechism. And catechism says that homosexual actions are intrinsically disordered because they do not lead to life, so it fails the baby's part, and they do not proceed from complementarity. In other words, in this physical interaction, there is not the complementarity that is necessary for union. God created man, male and female, with a distinction between the sexes, not for the purpose of aggravating one another, although that might seem sometimes to be the case, but for the purpose of union. In order to have union, you must first have difference and complementarity. And the love between homosexuals fails that. There's not that complementarity as evidenced by well, the theology of the body and the fact that physically we can say there's no complementarity there. It doesn't proceed from that. Okay. And again, this gets back to the conviction that our bodies display something true and objectively true about our souls and about God's order for creation. Now, I do not doubt that there is love between these couples, but it has sort of gone off track. It is being expressed in the wrong way. Okay, and there are some homosexual couples I know who have decided to live chastity because they love each other. They say, you know, we should stop doing this because we love each other. Okay, their love has not stopped, but it's been purified and become more of a genuine friendship. Okay. Is that? Yes.
Oh, okay. What would your response be to same-sex couple? I'm sorry. People of the same sex gender.
See, it's not easy, is it?
Who want to raise children?
Okay, those are same-sex attraction, homosexual couples who want to raise children. JP2, I don't know where, but he said that every child has a right to parents, but parents don't have a right to children. Okay, children are a gift, but every child has a right to mother and father, not to two fathers, not to two mothers. And the Vatican has been very, very strong in its language about this, that it does a certain degree of violence to the child because it just disrupts the, again, that complementarity between man and woman that God willed from the beginning. And you know what? We don't even need to talk about Scripture or God. We just look at creation, we look at humanity, and we say, gosh, there seems to be two kinds of people in the world, male and female, you know? That seems to be there for a reason. And there's no culture in the history of the world that has ever sanctioned that sort of thing. That's not a good argument with our culture because we think we're wiser than, you know, thousands of years of thinking. The adoption of children by homosexual couples, yeah, certainly should not be permitted at all. Because it's depriving the child of that complementarity in the parents that the child should see. Yes.
What are some of the main causes of homosexuality?
What are some of the main causes of homosexuality? Well, in my reading, the reading I've done for this, it is the father-son union is extraordinarily important, and a disruption of that can set the stage for same-sex attractions. Abuse. Those who are abused, especially if it's at a young age, that can derail a person's understanding of sexuality and just sort of skew the trajectory for their entire life. There is no one cause. What I have found is the importance of fathers. Okay? And I was here a couple years ago. Gave a talk on being a man and the importance of fathers really loving their sons and showing their sons what it means to be men. One of the best, but at the same time, most devastating lines I've heard is,
my father taught me a lot. He taught me how to make a living. He taught me how to get a job. He taught me how to be successful, but he didn't teach me how to be a man. Men learn how to be men from other men. And so if that affection between father and son is missing, a lot of times it's looked for somewhere else. Okay, that's not the catch-all. It's not the only one, but in my reading and my work, that's the one that, that stands out as probably the biggest. Last question. Right, Terry? Okay. Yes?
Earlier when you talked about finding an end result for people who are in the same, what the end result of the same-sex couple.
Right.
What if the end result is that they love each other, and so they don't have the definitions of Catholic love, they're not Catholic?
Okay. Well, okay, so what if a homosexual couple does not have, they're not Catholic, and so they don't have the same understanding of Catholic teaching on this? Well, the Catholic Church's teaching on this is not peculiar to Catholics. This is simply the Church teaching it because it's true. It doesn't become true because the Church teaches it. The Church teaches it because it's true. This is the Church articulating natural law, what is written into our human nature, what is the truth of human sexuality. And so, you know, what I said about the truth of human sexuality is this is not something that we know exclusively by divine revelation. And this is not something that we that is exclusive to the Catholic Church. You don't need to be Catholic to understand it and accept it and live by it. You don't need to believe in God to understand it, accept it, and live by it. It is in the very nature of the human person. That is the very nature of the human person's sexuality and of the marriage bond. Okay, so this is one of the reasons why Pope Benedict has been, including during his trip to the United States, he has been time and time again talking about the importance of natural law, that the truths that we are articulating are not exclusive to Catholics, that we are bearing the in what we teach, we are bearing the truth about the human person itself, and about human love, about human sexuality. Okay. Thank you.